Okay, let us start proceedings. I will mute people so that everybody can focus on the share. So good morning to everybody. Thank you all for joining. I will put the sheets on again in a few minutes. We are going to have today, Be'ezrat Hashem, a very exciting share. The topic of the share is going to be autopsies and dissection. Burial and all the mitzvahs associated with it, which is a very controversial issue in this country. It's a flashpoint between the religious and the secular communities. Every now and then this boils over and there's demonstrations of different kinds. It also, the shiur reads somewhat for all of those who are Sherlock Holmes fans, with apologies to Conan Doyle, the shiur reads a little bit like a series of Conan Doyle stories. We're going to deal with the curious case of the Rambam's toe, the node of Yehuda's tooth, the strange situation of the death row plea, the boiled prostitute, the grave digger and the alcoholic, and finally the case of the angry inheritors. So hopefully that will get you excited about what we're going to be talking about, because we really are dealing today with some fundamental, but really quite fun and in some ways quite eclectic material. Let me start with a few important announcements. There we have three sponsorships today, and I'd like to thank the sponsors very much for coming in and sponsoring the Shiurim. We're very grateful for all the sponsorship we receive. The first of all, the sponsorship is anonymous. The first sponsor says the Shiur is sponsored in appreciation by one of the students on the share. Thank you. I know who they are, but you don't know who they are, but they know who they are, and we're very grateful for their sponsorship. The second sponsorship is in memory of Shaul ben Michael on his 60th Yahrzeit, and I also don't know who was the sponsor for that, but I'm really grateful for that. Thank you. So please God, it should be an aliyah for the neshama of Shaul ben Michael. And finally, we have a sponsor who I do know and I can reveal. The Shiur is sponsored by Simon and Anna Wiseman. Dr. Simon and Anna Wiseman, who are here, I see them there. Thank you very much for the sponsorship. In memory of Natan Meir ben Shimon HaKohen, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, Norman Cohen, who is Anna's father, for his Yahrzeit, which is on the 18th of Tevet. So thank you to the Wisemans for the sponsorship. And as I mentioned to Simon, there are the medical content of the Shiur is actually very apposite for sponsorship from a medical family. And Simon actually sent me some fascinating research, which I really want to get to at the end of the Shiur. Hopefully we'll have time. Finally, but actually very importantly, I'd like to make a general announcement. The OU Israel Center is having a fundraising this week for the programming that they're doing over the last 8 months on Zoom. As I'm sure you're aware, there are hundreds and hundreds of people, Baruch Hashem, that are able to participate in the Zoom Shiurim, and they're all offered free, and we rely on sponsorship contributions to keep everything going. There's a lot of backroom production costs and hours of preparation that go in. So David will actually put on, David Hochhauser, who is our much appreciated tech supporter, is going to put onto the chat, if David's there, he'll put it on in a few minutes, I'm sure he is, the link for the fundraising campaign. There is still time to do that. Tax-deductible contributions can be made, and they work on the, you can get a SIF 46 receipt under the Israel Income Tax Code. So please, I would encourage you to do whatever you can to contribute to this campaign, which will hopefully enable the Shiurim to move forward and keep on going. I pray that one day we can be back on live. Yes, you had a question. Michael, you had a question? You're muted. I can't hear you.
Your video is very slow.
Well, it's the internet. There's nothing much I can do.
It's not synchronized.
I don't know if that's true for everybody, but everything is working at this end. All I can do is hope and pray that the internet will be faster and we'll do everything that we can in order to get there. We are recording the Shiurim, don't forget. If anybody misses anything, they can always pick up the recording. I also, if anything happens and I disappear, please don't leave. I will be back soon, and if the internet is bad for a few minutes, hopefully it'll be better after that. So, Michael, I'm sorry, you're right. I'm sure that people are having issues, but it's just the way it is. There's nothing more I can do in this end other than encourage the Gush Etzion to put more infrastructure investment in the cabling here. Okay, please write to your local MP, or as not as the case may be. Okay, fine. Let us get into the excitement of today's shiur. I'm going to share the screen. I'm also going to put the sheets here we are. They're going up one more time, and everybody who didn't get them before should be able to get those now. Okay, there they are. Let's talk a little bit about autopsies before we put the sheet on the screen. Since medicine first began, people have been looking at ways to improve therapies, to improve... Yeah, so someone's telling me that my bandwidth is low. Again, there's nothing I can do about that. I am totally at the mercy of the internet. Hopefully it will improve. Since the beginning of medicine, people have been trying to improve therapies and find ways of working out whether the cures that we put in place are working for other people, and autopsies and dissection has been a part of that. There has always been religious pushback against dissection from different religious groups, and we'll see from Judaism and Halakha as well. There are classic sources which deal with this in the Torah and in the Gemara as well. We're going to see those today. But this became a very much more live issue, if you don't mind the slightly inappropriate pun, when over the last 200 years, people started to really improve anatomy and work on dissection as a medical training and started medical schools. And therefore, as I said at the beginning, this is a flashpoint issue which flares up every now and then in Eretz Yisrael. There are lots of questions. Let me share the screen and you can have a look at some of those questions on the bottom here. When is it allowed halakhically to perform an autopsy? Whose permission do you need to perform an autopsy? Is it the person who died? Is it the next of kin? Are you allowed to take organs without permission to save life? What if the deceased specifically requested that his body or her body should be left for medical research? Does that make it okay? Is that permission acceptable? We'll see about that soon. Desecration of the dead? What does it mean, nivul hamet? What is involved in that prohibition? We'll talk about that soon. What about the mitzvah of burial? How fast does one have to bury a body? What are the circumstances in which one can delay that burial? What about life-saving activity? What is called life-saving activity? And we'll really focus much more on that next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, when we look at part two and the modern-day poskim. This is how I want to divide it. Today we're going to look at the Torah and the Gemara sources. Next week, please God, we're going to look at the poskim over the last 200 years. But what is called pikuach nefesh? Obviously, taking out an organ to put it into a waiting patient in life-threatening need is clearly pikuach nefesh. What about removing organs and body parts for future use, which people in life-saving situations will need? What about taking out organs or doing autopsies to see why a person died, cause of death, where that may affect the siblings, that may affect other people? What about in a pandemic, where you need to know how the disease progressed in order to treat others? What about a murder victim? Chas v'shalom, if somebody is killed and there is a murderer on the loose, can you do an autopsy which may or may not reveal the cause of death, which may or may not locate the killer, who may or may not strike again? Is that called pikuach nefesh? What about treatment, what about autopsies to develop future treatments by trained professionals? What about medical students who are not trained to do anything yet, but want to dissect bodies? My daughter-in-law actually is in medical school at the moment. She encouraged me to look into this topic. What is the story? Are you allowed to dissect a Jewish body, a non-Jewish body, just to train doctors who one day will maybe qualify as doctors and maybe in a life-preserving situation? So all of these questions come up. There are Kohanim questions which I don't propose to deal with. Can a Kohen ever be involved in dissections? Trained to be a doctor? Can a Kohen go to a funeral of a close relative who has not been fully buried? That is an interesting, fascinating question. If some parts of the body are left out of the burial, is the kohen allowed to become tamei for a parent, for a spouse, for a sibling, etc. And we'll also talk a little bit today about pain after death. Is that something which is relevant, and how that ties in? So all of these questions are really pressing questions. I hope that the internet is now working a bit better. I hope it's warming up a bit. If it isn't, then please, there must be some tehillim that are need to be sent out for good Zoom reception. If you know them, please say them, and then we'll get through the material. Okay, great. Why am I dealing with this now? As you know, that over the last 5 or 6 weeks, I have been taking themes from Sefer Bereishis. And one of the themes of the Parsha coming up right now, Vayechi, is death and burial. Because Yaakov dies and Yosef dies, but neither of them is buried in a classic way. Before this, of course, the Avos and the Imahos have been buried. Abraham, Yitzchak, and later Yaakov are buried in Maariv HaMakpela. Leah, it says explicitly, is buried in Maariv HaMakpela. Rachel, of course, is buried in Kever Rachel. Exactly where Kever Rachel is a topic we looked at about 3 years ago, and I put a reference to that shiur on the sheet. You can look at that issue now, or later. That's something off our topic a little bit. But when Yaakov dies, look what happens. Okay, let's dive into the first source in number one from the Chumash. So Yaakov passes away, and it says in the Chumash, "Vayipol Yosef al pnei aviv." Yosef fell on his father's face. "Vayeik alav," and he cried for him. "Vayishaklo," and he kissed him. He's now passed away. "Vayitzav Yosef et avadav," and Yosef commands his servants, "et rofim," the doctors. Interesting, the doctors appear here. The Egyptian, we'll see their embalmers. "Lachanot et aviv," to embalm his father. "Vayechanatu harofim et Yisrael," and the doctors or surgeons or whoever they were there, the embalmers, they embalmed Yaakov, they embalmed Yisrael. "V'yimalu lo arba'im yom," and there was then a 40-day period. "Ki chein yimlu'u yimei hachanutim," because that is the embalming period for the process of embalming. Fascinating that the psukim are giving us these time frames as to how embalming works. 40 days of embalming, and then v'yivku otom Mitzrayim, and then the Egyptians mourned for him and cried for him shivim yom, for 70 days. And we'll see these time periods of 40 and 70 days are actually very important in the whole process of embalming. And then later it says, "Vayisu otor banav arta Kanaan," the children carried him, of course, many, many months later, to Eretz Kanaan. He's been preserved, he's been embalmed. "Vayikbru otor b'maratah sadeh ha-machpela," and then they buried him in Maariv HaMakpela, in Hebron, "Hashekana Abraham et ha-sadeh lachuzot kaveh me'eteh from achiti al-pnei mamre." Every time Maariv HaMakpela is mentioned, there is a clear geographical location to make sure that we know exactly where that is. Okay. So Yaakov was, this process of chanika was carried out on Yaakov's body. He wasn't buried immediately. So too, number two, Yosef, at the very end of the parasha, "Vayamat Yosef ben mea ve'esher shanim," we're told that Yosef died at 110. It's important, we'll see why he's 110. "Vayachanatu otor," and they also embalmed him. "Vayisam ba'aron b'mitzrayim," and he was placed in a coffin in Egypt, but it doesn't say he was buried. It doesn't say he was put in the ground. He was placed in a coffin, embalmed, and there he stayed for hundreds of years. Until eventually, later on, it says that Moshe took the bones, the remains of Yosef, that had been embalmed, and took them back to Mitzrayim, took them back to Eretz Yisrael. So, you have this mention here in the Pesukim itself of Chanita. What is Chanita? So there are two basic approaches. I want to talk about this just for 5-10 minutes and then get into the main focus today, which is the whole question of autopsy. But the most of the Mepharshim go down the route and say, Chanita is embalming, and the word embalm in English, of course, is from the word balm, which is oil. To put someone in oils and preserve them, and spices, and preserve them so that the body does not decompose. Look, for example, I'll give you three quick hits at these sources in 3, 4, and 5. Rashi, inyan merkachat besamim hu. It's merkachat besamim. It's some kind of concoction of spices, okay? By the way, the word balm in English is derived from the word balsam, which itself is derived from the word besamim. Very interesting. So look at the Da'as Kanim number 4. Hintiku gufa, they preserved his body. La'achashi shlicho bosamim, they threw spices onto it, hamarim, special bitter spices, kidei lahoiti tzitzinus mehameav, bebeav, to take out the food that's left in the stomach, that obviously is going to rot and cause decomposition of the body. They tried to get that out. Kidei shelo yitzrach, and so that the body wouldn't decompose, hishlicho batocha achrei ken, samim mutukim lahareich reich tov. Okay? Spices, oil to give a good odor. A good aroma. Number five, similarly, the Bechor Shor. Lachnot, he uses the word enbalmir. Enbalmir, which is to embalm, balaz. V'nira shehu mishemen zayid shelo hiviu. Shlish, a certain kind of olive oil. V'ha'umnim merkachim oto lechanot bo adam, v'chein asu liyosef. That's what they did to Yaakov, that's what they did to Yosef. Rabbeinu Bachya wants to make the point here, which is implied in these previous sources, that embalming is specifically covering the body. It's not dissecting the body. Look at what he says, Rabbeinu Bachya here in number 6. V'yichanetu harofim. Inyachan achenita, hishehayu merkachim oto bebasamim zanim. Five different kinds of spices and preservatives. V'zehaya acharachitza, first they would wash the body. U'masha amar v'yichanetu, when it says they embalmed him, shetzivu la'asod ken kayu habakim achokma b'katzeva, the doctors there knew what to do, the natural scientists. Lo sheyigiu arofim begufo. Not that they would actually cut up his body. And the Rabbeinu Bachya wants to stress, like we've seen in these three, four sources, that chanita, according to them, is not mummification. It's not mummification. It's embalming, preserving, but they wouldn't touch his body. He wouldn't cut it up. However, there's a whole separate set of sources. And I've started here with Rav Shmuel ben Chofni, one of the lesser quoted but important early sources. That says, no, actually Yaakov's body was mummified, and so was Yosef's body. Look at what he says here, and this is in contrast to the previous sources, which stressed, no, just embalming. Look at number 7, Bechor Shor. Lachnotit aviv, perisho habarur hu chanita. This is the explanation of chanita. V'zeha yoter mima she'otzem leksat ha'meisim bizmanim. This is more than we do today to our bodies. Ki hu hitkaven bazeh liyibush lechutav. Yibush, to desiccate, to dry out all of the moisture in the body. They would use oil. And they would also use mumia. This is where the word mummy comes from. Mummy, in an Egyptian sense, has got nothing to do with mummies and daddies. It's to do with the word mumia, meaning a certain kind of wax that they would use in order to preserve the body. And Rav Shmuel ben Chofni mentions it. Kidei lishmor al gufoteihem, so they would preserve the body. Hey, tachzik ma'amad hodot ha'yibush, good, and it would really accelerate as a catalyst for this process of desiccation. Ulachein amar et ha'rofim, and that's why they picked the rofim, because they had the special knowledge. And he points out here, v'yimlulo arba'im yom, and they waited 40 days, hari mistabesh izeu shir hazman shal yibush lechotot. He links it with the chemical process of mummification. This is how long it took. V'amrin, it says, kichein yimlu'u yimei achanatim. Now, actually, I brought you here on page 3 a little summary of how the Egyptians used to mummify bodies. There's an 11-stage process. I'm not an expert on mummification, although I did discover completely randomly that it wasn't just the Egyptians. The Sicilians, you can Google this later. In Sicily, there was an ancient custom of mummifying bodies in the crypts of the churches. So this is something that went on in Europe as well. But you'll see basically, as you probably know, what they did is they cut open the body, they removed the internal organs, they allowed them to dry, put them in special ritual jars. They then put salt on the body for 70 days, fascinating 70 days that we saw in the Pasuk as well. And then after 40 days, they would stuff the body with linen, with sand, etc. 70 days, they would wrap it in bandages, and they would put it in a sarcophagus. So what you're seeing here is that there is clearly a connection between the time periods in the Pesukim and the ancient art of Egyptian mummification. And in fact, the Abar Banel jumps in absolutely clearly and says, yes, it was complete mummification. Look at the Abar Banel in number 10. Why were they his servants? They knew what they were doing in these systems of mummification. And this is important, right? It was specifically for kings. This was for the royalty. V'hem chantu et Yisrael, they carried this out on Yisrael. V'chanata hi, what is that, says the Abarbanel, hoitzat hamoach, removal of the brain, v'halev, and then the heart, v'hachaved, and the liver, v'chein ameyayim, and the intestines, v'amarurut, shemitoch aguf, and the spleen, and all of the things that will decompose the body. And then they would smear it, they would anoint it on the inside, on the outside, with special kinds of oil. And they would fill the insides and the outsides, and they would cover it with spices, etc. What you're clearly seeing here is the Abarbanel describing classic mummification as carried out by the Egyptians on their kings, which is exactly what Rashi and Bechor Shor and Rabbeinu Bachya said was not the case. And in fact, I brought you here a tshuva of the Rav Nasha Klein, the Mishneh Halachas, where he's responding to somebody who read, I'm not going to go through this in detail, but somebody wrote to him and said they read that Rav Issa Yehuda Unterman in a journal in presumably in the 1960s, yes, Tashin Yud Gimel, 1953, brought down this idea that Yaakov was mummified with all that goes with it, and this writer was outraged. How could Rabbi Issa Yehuda Unterman say that? And Rav Menashe Klein writes back to him and says, you're right, chas v'shalom, but you do know that this is what the Abarbanel says. It's not that Rav Unterman was making this up. It's not some kind of academic analysis. This is a classic approach in the post-game as well. So there you basically see two approaches to the mummification. Either it was embalming without mummification, or it was mummification. Was Yosef appropriate in asking this? And I just want to touch on this briefly. If you look here in number 13, the Midrash raises this question. It says that Yosef lived 110 years. Now, 110 is an interesting age. By the way, 110, if you look in ancient Egyptian sources, 110 in Egypt was considered a full and well-lived life. That was a relevant number in Egypt too, which, by the way, is very important, because the fact that the Chumash speaks to the ancient Near Eastern reality is critical to date it in the time of the ancient Egyptian period. Because these connections between the Chumash and the ancient world are critical to debunk, if you like, biblical criticism, which claims a much later authorship of Torah, which would not be possible because they would not have known any of these earlier things. There's a lot to be said about this. If you picked up Professor Josh Berman's recent book, Ani Ma'amin, it's a very, very interesting read. He talks about this. This is his field, showing how the Torah dates itself very clearly at the time of Har Sinai, and not at a later date as claimed by academics. Okay, he's also an academic, but that's not for now. So look what the Midrash says, number 13. Lama meit Yosef bifnei achav. Why did Yosef die before his brothers? So Rebbe Rabbanon, there's a machlokas Rebbe in the Rabbanon. Rebbe omer al shechanat at aviv. Rebbe says it's because he should never have embalmed his father. This was wrong to do. Amalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says to him, midrashically, lo ha'iti yachol lishmor el et tzadikai. Am I not able to preserve my own tzadikim? There's an ancient midrashic tradition, maybe even a physical tradition, that the bodies of tzadikim do not decompose. Why did you do this? Why would you need to embalm him? The Rabbanon said no. Hu shitziva oto shechantu oto. Yaakov asked him. It was the request of the deceased. And this is why it's so important for us, because how far does the request of the deceased go? If the deceased says, yes, I don't want you to bury me, I want you to cremate me, does that have any relevance? Do they ignore it? Do they say, yes, yes, fine, we'll cremate you, and then when the person dies, they say, no way, we'll bury you? What about if they say, I want my body to be given to medical research? How does that work? So apparently Yaakov asked Yosef to do this, so Yosef is off the hook. And I brought you a number of Meforshim here, which I'm not going into in detail, about how one of the justifications, according to the Rabbanon, for Yosef's actions is that it was covered hametz. And we'll get back to this right now in the halacha. Look for a second in number 14, the Orachaim. Yichanatu arofim, asachein liYosef mishum kvoid aviv. It was kibud avim. Kichein mishpat hanichbadim. This was the law for all respected royalty. All the more so the actual kings themselves. Also, they didn't want people to think that Yaakov had not died, or had been preserved without mummification, and they would make him into an avodah zara, make him into a god. And one of the things that we see is kovod hameis, kovod hameis. If you do something to the deceased, which is not a desecration, but actually an honor for the deceased, then other things are allowed that would not normally be allowed, and we'll talk about how that works right now in a few minutes. The sources number 16 and 17 I will leave you to read on your own. It's the Malbim and Rav Hirsch, each giving a perspective on how embalming and mummification in Egypt is in contrast to the Jewish perspective on body and soul. There's a whole shiur to be said on these, but I'm not going to get into it now. But each of them explains how the Egyptians understood that the body has to be preserved in order for the soul to stay connected to it. Otherwise the soul would, you know, be lost. So they were very specifically trying to preserve the body. Whereas the Jewish perspective is to dissolve the body, to put the body in the ground, and the body is no longer relevant, and the soul will be eternal without any connection to the body. Is that true of everybody? Are there some people where the soul is more connected to the body? Again, please do your own reading, number 16, number 17, on contrast between Judaism and Egyptian culture when it comes to body and soul. Fine. Let's get into the main focus of the shiur, which is burial. Let's look at some key sources, and then we'll understand what the mitzvah is. So the pasuk deals with burial later. We don't, as we saw a few weeks ago, we don't follow mitzvahs because they appear in Parshas Bereishis. Remember, we looked at this idea that we don't do Mila because Avram did Mila, and we don't keep Gidah Nasha because it's mentioned in Parshas Vayishlach. We keep them because after the Torah was given, these mitzvahs were repeated or reiterated. So too here. Have a look in number 18, please. Loi salim nivlasa al ha'eitz. Who is this talking about? A capital criminal who has been killed by Beis Din, by its shrefa, that he's been, skila, he's been stoned by the Beis Din. There were other forms of capital punishment as well, but somebody who was stoned by the Beis Din and killed was later hung on a tree. Don't allow him to remain on the tree. Loi salim nivlasa al ha'eitz. Don't allow him to remain overnight on the tree. Ki kavor tigberena b'yom ha'hu. You must bury him on that day. And there's a debate in the postgame. Does that mean before night? Does that mean that day before the next sunrise? There are different approaches. Ki klilat Elohim talui. Because this is a disgrace to Elohim. Either it means Elohim in the sense of God, because the person is b'tselem Elohim, in the image of God, not physically, but they carry the soul. Or it means it's a disgrace to the judges who judge the case, which I'm not getting into now. Talui, his hanging remains a disgrace. So like Tameh Ad Matcha, do not make impure the land. Don't defile the land. So there is a mitzvah. In fact, we'll see two mitzvahs to bury even a capital criminal on the day that he was hanged. Actually, the correct word is hung. For those of you who are excited about English grammar issues, whether you say hanged or hung depends on whether the person was killed by hanging or hung afterwards. If that's something that you're into, then I've, you know, brought you a note on that as well. But what are the mitzvahs here? There are actually two mitzvahs. The Sefer HaChinuch brings them down, and we need to read them inside. Look in 19 and 20. There's a negative mitzvah, number 19. Shelo yalin hatsaluv. Don't allow to remain overnight someone who was hung up, al ha'eitz on the tree, v'chein ha'meis v'beisa, or even someone who dies at home, ela lichvoido. You can only delay for their kavod, for their honor. And look at what he says of the details here. Shelona azov ha'talu she'alin ha'eitz. Don't allow this criminal to remain on the tree, and he brings the potik. V'loshon sifrikan, he quotes Chazal, lo salin nivlato al ha'eitz, zo mitzvat lo ta'aseh. That is a negative mitzvah. And he says, I'm going to explain the mitzvah in the following entry in Sefer HaChinuch, which is the positive mitzvah. So let's now go to the positive mitzvah in 20. What is that? Mitzvah kvura, the mitzvah of burial, leneherag alpi beit din, to someone who was killed by the beit din, v'chein l'chol meis, and to every dead body. Says the Chinuch, likpor bi shenitla b'yom hahu. There is a mitzvah to bury the person who was hung up on the same day, and he brings the Chazal again. The lashon sifrei, the lashon of the sifrei here is ki kavotik barena b'yom hahu mitzvat aseh. So you see here two mitzvot, a lot aseh and an aseh, and he says here midini hamitzvahs mashe amri zichron nivrachum she'ein mitzvah zo v'nitla levad. This is not only for a criminal, who was hung on a tree. Ela af kol haruge beit din, it applies to all those killed by beit din. Mitzvah lekobram b'yom harigasam, you have to bury them that day. V'gam b'chlal ha-mitzvah likbor kol meis mi-Yisrael b'yom moto. And that extends, the part of the Torah mitzvah is every Jewish person who dies has to be buried wherever possible on that day, not just a criminal. And therefore somebody who has no one to bury them, they call that mace a mace mitzvah. Why is it called a mace mitzvah? To reiterate the idea that there is a mitzvah, in fact two mitzvahs, a positive and a negative, to bury the body immediately. Everyone has the mitzvah, the kovroi, mitzad hatzibur hazeh. If there's time at the end, I will tell you a story that once when I was involved with a mace mitzvah, but there probably won't be time at the end, but if there is, then it's an interesting story. And then he talks about the fact that this mitzvah applies at all times for men and for women, etc., and anyone who breaks it is guilty, is breaking two mitzvahs. Now, just let me come in here for a second and focus on an interesting question. The mitzvah to bury every Jew is derived from the mitzvah to bury a capital criminal. That's an interesting system, that's an interesting analysis. Why would the Torah bring the case of someone such a low-grade individual and learn from that the mitzvah for every Jewish person? And the answer is that the Torah often does that, or at least sometimes does that. It takes an extreme case and learns a kal v'chomer, if it applies even then, all the more so it applies in a regular situation. Let me bring you two examples, three examples, clearly one is this one. You might have thought that a capital criminal, let him hang. You know, it was completely commonplace in the general population to hang criminals on the walls of the city and let them rot. You might have thought, well, he deserves it. He's the low life of all low lives. No, even such a person has to be buried. All the more so somebody who has the status of a full part member of society, kal v'chomer. An extreme example, learning to the general example. Two other mitzvah examples. Where do we learn in the Torah the mitzvah that a man has to treat his wife appropriately, give her onak, sukkah, she'erah, give her all the things that a Jewish wife has? We learn it from the case where someone marries an ama ivriya, a maidservant who is sold into a family to find her a shidduch that she can marry one of the men in the family. So it says it in that mitzvah. Why? Because you might have thought, listen, she's the maid. Really? She gets all of the financial deal that a Jewish wife gets? Yes. Even she gets the deal, all the more so a regular wife who is not a maid. And another example, the mitzvah of tzniut, is learned for someone in a battlefield situation where they need to use the bathroom. There's a psukim there in Dvarim. In Kisetze say that a person, when they need to use the bathroom in the battlefield, they must do it in a dignified manner. They must go outside the camp, dig a hole, cover over after them. Even though, God forbid, they may be killed any second, they're in extremis, they're stressed. No, even in a situation there is a human dignity, all the more so, this is learned as to the mitzvah of tzniut in every other situation. So that is quite an interesting system that the Torah uses to stress the mitzvah from an extreme case to a regular case. Fine. So there are two mitzvahs of burial. Interestingly, the Yerushalmi picks up on the fact that you have to bury the whole body. Look at number 21. Tikvarenu, kulo, all of the body. Velo miksato, not part of the body. Tikvarenu, what does it mean? Mikan she'im shiyer mimeno, if you left some of the body out of the burial and kept it behind for any other reason. Lo asaklum, you didn't do the mitzvah at all. Shinema, he repeats the words, ki kavor tikvarenu. And of course, this is very well known, that we make every possible effort to bury every single part of the dead that is with them when they die. And that's why the tzaddikim that work for organizations like Zaka, which stands for Zihui Korbanot Asom, that go around where people are loyalenu killed in terribly tragic circumstances, they make sure that they find every single little drop of blood and piece of the body that was there to make sure that they have a burial. By the way, this only applies to what is with a person when they die. There is no requirement to keep all the hair and the teeth and the nail clippings, you'll be pleased to know, that you ever had, and make sure you keep them somewhere safe so they can be buried with you. That is not a halachic requirement, and people don't do that. Having said that, there are a few stories. There is a mitzvah that someone came to when the Rambam died. He came to someone in a dream. This is brought down by Rav Avadya Yosef. He came to someone in a dream and told them that he had a toe amputated earlier in life. They had to track down the toe and find it and bury it with the Rambam's body in Severia. And so it was. That's how the story goes anyway. And also the Nodib Yehuda apparently came to somebody in a dream and said he had a tooth that he needed to be located to be buried with him. But this is not halakhically required. This is maybe a mystical idea. There is no requirement to bury everything you ever have. Amputated limbs, by the way, is fascinating. If a person has a limb amputated, do they have is there a requirement to bury it? Well, they're still alive. They may be alive for another 50 years. I'm not getting into that now. I brought you some sources on that in a reference at the bottom. Okay, so let's look at the issues now that may affect autopsy. Burial is obviously one of them. There is a mitzvah to bury every part of the body, if possible, that day, unless it's for kavod hamit, and we'll have to analyze. Is it an honor for the dead to have an autopsy done, to save life through that body? We'll talk about that more next time. But there are three other issues. Nivul Hamet, Hana'at Hamet, and Kaparat Hamet, which we need to plug in. Today we're getting all the sources lined up so that next week when we see the Tshuvot, we'll have everything we need. So let's have a look at these. Nivul Hamet. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, number 22, learns, Tashma, Hilinu Lichvoda, if you left the mate overnight for honoring the dead, Lahavilo Aron, to find a proper coffin, with tachrichen or proper shrouds. Ain all that love? That's, you're not breaking the mitzvah. So it's for kavod. Now, who's kavod? My love lichvodo shel meit. Isn't that for honoring the dead? Says the Gemara here, no. Lo, lichvodo shel chai. Maybe that's for the relatives. Maybe that's for the family. It's honor for them. Umishim kvodo shel chai. My little mate, for honor for the living, you would allow the dead to stay overnight. So the Gemara says, yes, that's true. You may not leave the criminal overnight. That's because it's a disgrace. But in a case where there is no disgrace, there's no nivul, there's no bizayon to the dead. It's not a problem. So clearly we have a situation where if you can define something as being for the honor of the dead, or even maybe for the honor of the living. Look in number 23. Kola oselich vodo shel chai, says the Gemara there. Anything you do for the living, ain bo bizeon lemeit, is by definition not a disgrace for the dead. So once you can define these mitzvahs, you will know a little bit better whether these autopsy questions, someone asked, can a body lie in state? An interesting question. Now that is not the minag of Israel to allow bodies to lie open in state, but certainly funerals are sometimes delayed so that people can come to them. And this is a fascinating halachic question, which can cause a lot of hardship and stress. Are you allowed to delay a funeral in Israel so that relatives from Chutz La'aretz can get to the funeral? Some poskim say, yes, that's kvodo shel meit, that's an honor for the dead so that the living can be there. And others say, no, leaving a body overnight unburied in Eretz Israel is a nivul hamet, is a bizayon hamet. It's not appropriate for the dead. So that defining that is going to be an important question. So that's one issue. A second issue, apart from nivul and kavod hamet, is hana'ah. Look in number 24, a Gemara in Avodah Zorah. Ma meis asur b'hana'ah, af zevach nami asur b'hana'ah. Just like a dead body, a deceased body is no longer, you may not get any benefit from it. So to a sacrifice to Avodah Zorah, they connect the two. Now, how do I know that a body is not allowed to be used for benefit? Umeis gufe minalan. How do I know the idea that you can't get benefit from a body? Asya sham sham. It brings the Gezeira Shava. It links, the Gemara links two parashas in the Torah. The Egla Arufa, from Egla Arufa. Ksiv hacha, it says with Miriam, the Tamat sham Miriam. Miriam died there. Ksiv hasam, with Egla Arufa, it says the arfu sham et Egla banacha. So there's a connection between these two parshas, the death of Miriam and the Egla Rufa, just like you can't benefit from the Egla Rufa, the heifer that has its neck broken, so too you can't benefit from the dead body. Umala halam osabahano, just as one is prohibited to benefit, afkan nami osabahano. Ah, and how do I know with the egla rufa? So he learns that from other korbanot for kosher purposes, not for avodah zarah, and there's a complex chain of limudim. What do I get from this? I get from this the idea that there's a prohibition of any kind of hana'ah from a body. Now, what's called hana'ah? If I sit on a grave, is that prohibited? What if I use a body in order to save another life? Is that a hana'ah which is prohibited? Well, presumably, pikuach nefesh, if we can define pikuach nefesh, which we will do next week, will certainly override this prohibition. Even if it's a Torah prohibition, which is debated, whether it's a Torah or a rabbinic prohibition. Certainly, if it's rabbinic, but even if it's Torah, pikuach nefesh will override it. But I need to work out what's hana'ah. What about watching a dissection? Is that called hana'ah from a mate? Remember, there were some fairly tasteless exhibitions of dead bodies that they had in London. I think they had them in America. Do you know what I'm talking about? If you remember this, there was a whole furore. Is that called hana'ah from a mate? Leaving aside a Cohen walking into the museum, is that highly inappropriate benefit from the dead? Is looking just... That's not for now. We'll talk more about that next week. And finally, before we get into the specific cases of autopsy in the Gemara, let's just look at the issue of kapara. This is an important spiritual one. So the Gemara there in the same place in Sanhedrin where discussing burial, 25 says as follows. Iboilu. They ask the following question. Kvura, why do we bury people so quickly? Mishum bizyonahu, bizyonah, is it because of a desecration of the body? Or mishum kaparahu, maybe it's because of atonement for the neshama. The mind asks Kamina, what's the difference? Why does it matter? A big difference. Da'ama loy ba'ina li kavru, le kvura, ahu gavra. If a person says, I don't want to be buried, I want to be given over to medical research. I amrot mishum bizyanahu, if you say the problem is desecrating the dead, loy kal kamina, then he can't make that statement. Why? Rashi explains, because it's a bizayon for his family. This person has a relative who is now lying in a hospital being dissected by medical students. It's not your body. You can't turn around and say, I don't care about the bizayon, because it's not just yours. It's the family's. However, says the Gemara, iyamak yishum kapara. Maybe it's because of kapara, meaning a person says, I don't mind delaying my atonement. So then he can do what he likes. A person can say, it's my neshama and nobody else's, and if I don't care about the kapara, then you have to respect my wishes. What is this idea of kapara? So the Gemara again says, kapara, number 26, me'emasai kahavia, when does the atonement for the deceased begin? B'kichazu tzara de kfura purta, once he begins the tzara, the pain of the being buried, and this is obviously a spiritual issue, and I brought you a Gemara in Shabbos that says that the neshama can feel a little bit, whatever this means, I have no idea what this really means, but it can feel a little bit the pain of the burial of the body as it is buried and decomposes. That's an important part of the kapara process. That's critical. And therefore, we have to decide whether delaying a burial is going to delay this atonement, and whether it's up to the person to make a choice. If they're neshama, they can do what they like or not. Fine. So we've seen that there are four basic issues. The mitzvah, the double mitzvah of burial, the question of bizayon, of nivul hamet, is desecrating the body, the issue of benefiting from the body, and the issue of atonement for the neshama. Now let's look now at five cases in the Gemara which talk about autopsy, which I think is fascinating. I wasn't really familiar with this until I researched this for the shiur. These five cases, you couldn't find five more interesting cases if you tried. Let's go with the first one. There's someone on death row. They killed another person. So they are about to be executed as a murderer. There is a halacha that if the person who was the victim, if the person who died was a trefa meaning they themselves had a critical illness that they would probably not have lived another year anyway, then if someone murders them, it's still murder, they're still a murderer, but they don't get the death penalty. That's a halacha. So how do I know whether this victim of murder was a trefa? Maybe that person would never have lived the year out anyway, and how can I possibly kill this murderer, maybe he's not liable to the death penalty. That's a pikuach nefesh question. Have a look in number 28. These sources are the key ones for today, so let's focus on these. The Amar Rahman, the Torah says the Gemara, Kakla, kill the murderer. The Lechush deal ma treifa hava. Maybe the victim was a treifa. How do I know? And Elav Mishum Damrini, we have to say that we assume Zilbasa Rubba. We follow the majority, even with Pikuach Nefesh. Most people are not treifas. Most people are healthy, expect to live out the year. So we can assume that the victim was also healthy until he was murdered. And now, you know, we can kill the murderer. Okay? Someone just popped something on the chat. What did they put? Assisted euthanasia. Not sure why exactly it's assisted euthanasia, but we'll maybe talk about that afterwards. So the Gemara then says, V'chitema debat kinan le, says the Gemara, let's do an autopsy. Let's examine the murder victim and see whether they were indeed a traitor. Why rely on a majority? You don't have to rely on a majority. After all, again, this is pikuach nefesh. There's someone on trial who is about to be executed. Let's do an autopsy. So the Gemara says, how can we know? How could you do an autopsy? It would be a desecration of the dead. It would be nivul hamet. So the Gemara answers, well, one second, it's pikuach nefesh. Of course, that would override nivul hamet. The kitema mishum ibud neshama, and if you want to turn around and say, okay, pikuach nefesh, you'll be allowed to do an autopsy. Yahavi namvali, but then we can do the autopsy. No, nechu shema b'makom saif nekev hava. We are concerned that the autopsy won't be useful. Why not? Because what's left of this person, it's quite possible that the place that they would have been discovered to be a traitor was where the murder weapon went, and therefore the autopsy will be inconclusive. And therefore you cannot do an autopsy which will be inconclusive. Now, interesting. Just let's summarize what we've got from that source. That source clearly seems to tell us that autopsy is allowed for pikuach nefesh, as long as it'll be helpful. If it won't be helpful, then it's not allowed, because all you're doing is desecrating a body for nothing. Now, that will depend on the state of science. It'll depend on what you call helpful. It'll depend on how you define pikuach nefesh. There was a case in London a few years ago where a baby, Loyalenu, died shortly after a Brit. Very rare, but it can happen. And they asked the Shaila, is there any justification for autopsy? And the based in, I think it was the London based in there, but I need to check out the exact facts, said absolutely. Because if this child had a congenital defect and died as a result of this operation, maybe a future child would have that as well. And there's a real, that's called pikuach. Maybe they're existing, maybe there are brothers and sisters right now. Actually, I think it wasn't the future child, it was the existing siblings. Maybe the existing siblings have something that you're not aware of, that you now need to check what was the problem with the baby so you can check on the children. That's called pikuach nefesh. We'll talk about all of these different layers of pikuach nefesh next week. What about future pikuach nefesh, etc. So what you get from case number one in the Gemara is if it will help and it will save life, then it's okay. But if it won't help, then it's not. Okay, that's case number one. Case number two, the case of the angry inheritors. What's going on here? So the Gemara says, number 29, Maisa b'Bnei Brak. There was something happened in Bnei Brak. All sorts of fun things happen in Bnei Brak, even to this very day. But this is what happened then. Shemachar b'Nichse Aviv Umeis. A young man inherited a fortune and sold it all to somebody else. And then he died. Ubal b'Nei Mishpacha. And the family then came after the death. The Irur, and they complained. And they said, Katan Hayabashat Misa. This person who died was a kid. He had no right to sell all of these family the family inheritance. And therefore the sale is invalid. We want our money back. We want our inheritance. So they came to Rabbi Akiva, who was the Rav of Nebrak. Ubao Vashalu et Rabbi Akiva. They came and they asked Rabbi Akiva, Mao Leboita, can we do an autopsy? Can we exhume this young man who's tragically died, and check, was he indeed a 13 years old and a godel in halacha when he sold the property, or was he not? So Amalahem, so Rabbi Akiva said to them, Iyatem Rishan Lenavla. Now, you cannot desecrate the body. You may not do that. Va'oid, and furthermore, It won't help even if you do an autopsy now, because whatever medical signs would have been there at death to establish whether this young man was a minor or had reached the bar mitzvah, you won't be able to see them anymore. It will have decomposed, and therefore it won't help. So the Gemara analyzes here, why these two reasons? You know, how do these reasons play together? So number 30, which I'm not going to read out in detail, is the analysis of the Gemara that goes on from that. And the Gemara basically says, what was the case here? And it says, well, it presumably, the property had been sold, and the purchasers now had it, and the family were coming to try and get it back. And there, Rabbi Akiva turned around and said, your family, and therefore it's a disgrace for you to dig up your family member, and it also won't work. But the purchasers, if it was the other way around, let's say the purchasers claimed that they were, they were entitled to the property, they were losing a lot of money. So the Gemara suggests, well, maybe they would have been allowed to do an autopsy because it's not their relative. Look at Tosfos for a second in number 31. Tosfos says here, for the purchasers, that's a different situation. Zuzi yavinan v'lenavle elavu. We don't care as much if we do the autopsy, not our relative. Says the Tosfos about Yorshim, but the inheritors, the family, Einol Mershaim Lenavla, they are more restricted. Bishvil HaYerusha, just to get their inheritance. Deloy Midiya, because they're not really losing anything that they have. They're losing the potential to inherit future money. Va'id, and also Shehu Krovam, and he's their relative. And that's an important point in case number two. The purchasers would be giving up money that they had. They bought land. They paid money. To take that away from them is a real monetary loss. Whereas the family would just be getting an inheritance that they thought they were entitled to, but maybe they weren't because this young man had sold it. This raises a fascinating question. Under what situations can you do an autopsy for other needs? There was one of the tshuvas of the Binyan Sion, Rav Etlinger. There was a family who lost a relative, who was buried, and they then discovered, they looked for the jewels, and they looked for the gold, which they thought was in the house of this elderly relative, and they found it wasn't there, and they discovered it had been buried with him. One way to really upset your family after you go, okay? And they discovered, and they ran to Rav Etlinger and said, we've got to dig him up, because, all the money's there. And he said, no, sorry, boys and girls, but probably the boys, you can't dig him up. You cannot desecrate a body to get an inheritance that you thought you were entitled to, and it turned out that you weren't. So that's something to check maybe with your family as the need arises. But what about another case? What about an aguna? What about a woman whose husband has gone missing? And they find a body which is buried, or even before it's buried, but they can't tell who it is. Would that be allowed to do an autopsy to allow the woman to remarry? And there the poskim have said yes, because even though it's not pikuach nefesh, that's the case of extreme need, more so than just getting the inheritance, and there are tshuvas which have permitted autopsy in order to allow an aguda to remarry. Okay, so that's case number two, the case of the angry inheritors. Case number three, I hope you're enjoying these cases. This is the case of Cleopatra and the pregnant maids. Let's have a look here. Number 32 in Nida. Tanya, Rabbi Yishmael Omer, Rabbi Yishmael said the following. Time, v'tiher, v'zachor. There's tumah and a period of tumah when a woman has a baby boy and then she becomes tahora, 40 days. V'time, v'tiher, v'nikeva. And there's a period of tumah for a girl of 80 days. And then the woman becomes tahora. Ma kishetime v'tihir b'zachar, just like with the case of a boy, it's 40 days. Yitzirato kiyotzebo, so a male embryo takes 40 days to form. He connects the halachic period of tumah to the embryology of the formation of a male in the womb. Af kishetime v'tihir b'nekeva, so too with a woman, since it's 80 days, yitzirato kiyotzebo, it takes 80 days for a girl to form. So Rabbi Yishmael proposes that there is a difference in timing between a male and a female in the womb. So Amru Lloyd said, the rabbis responded to him, Ein lemeidim yitira mituma. You can't learn embryology from halacha in Tumah v'Tara. It doesn't fit. Amarai, and they said to him, and we'll prove it to you. Amarai Rabbi Shmuel, Mata b'Cleopatra, Malkath Alexandros, the Ptolemaic queen Cleopatra, who was, of course, in Egypt in Alexandria. There were a bunch of maidservants who had been sentenced to death. Who knows why, what they did, but they were all going to be executed. So she said, let's do an experiment. Okay? The Harigala Malchus, they were going to be executed by the government. So she got them all pregnant before the executions, at different stages of pregnancy. Okay? Ubaku, and then she did autopsies on all of them afterwards. And she found that those who were pregnant with males and those who were pregnant with females, the fetus was formed in the same way. There was no difference in timing. Fascinating. A mass autopsy system that she got all of these maids pregnant and then examined the fetuses in different stages of development, says the Gemara. So Rabbi Shmuel was not interested. Amar lahem, he said to them, Ani meivi lachem ra'im min ha-Torah. I'm bringing you proofs from the Torah. Va'atem meivim lo ra'im min ha-Shoitim. And you're bringing me riots from fools? You know, we can't bring proofs from Cleopatra. Why not? He says, how can you know when the maids became pregnant? Maybe they were pregnant already. Maybe they were pregnant from someone else. And he rejects it. But again, interesting that there is a case there of an autopsy, a mass autopsy, but that's by Cleopatra, who obviously is not Jewish. But interesting to see how that works. The fourth case, which I have called the curious case of the boiled prostitute, which I think is definitely worthy of a Conan Doyle title. It says the Gemara, Maaseh b'talmidah shal Rabbi Yishmael. There is a case of the Talmidim of Rabbi Yishmael, Sheshalku zayna, they boiled. Now, shalku usually means boiled, it could sort of rendered it, or it could mean that dissected, but it probably means boiled. Zayna achas shin chayvu streifa lamelech. A certain prostitute that had been killed, had been burnt by the king, for whatever crime she committed. Bodku, and they checked out her remains, and they did an autopsy, and they found 252 limbs of the body. This is a discussion in the Gemara, how many limbs are there in a male body, and how many limbs are there in a female body. And interesting, that medical research they did on the body of a zona, I assume she was a non-Jewish zona, but they did it after she was killed, and they investigated and found 252 limbs in her body. Which, by the way, I brought you a footnote, that this is a fairly accurate analysis based on what we now know in terms of modern medicine, certainly more accurate than some of the other ones in the ancient world, which said more like 100 bones. Of course, it depends on how you define a limb and a bone, but interesting case in that of Rabbi Shmuel's students. Interesting, Rabbi Shmuel himself was a Kohen, so presumably it wasn't him that did it, but the students. And finally, and I'll leave you with this, Abba Shaul, look in number 34, final source. Abba Shaul Omer, Kover Meitim Haiti. I used to be involved in Kvuras, and back in the day, don't forget, they used to bury the body, and then later exhume the body, put the bones, once the bones had been with the remains, and put them in a family ossuary. Okay? I used to, but this was my job, he says. And I made a research project of examining the bones of the dead. And I followed up, and I discovered that people who've been drinking too much during their life of strong wine, at the Moisav Serufim, their bones were all dried out, were all burnt. Mozug, if they drank decent wine, at the Moisav Serufim, they were a different kind of dry level of dryness. Okay, the Karuyan, if they had a sensible approach to alcohol, Meshuchim, their bones were healthy. There was marrow in their bones. So it says, Abba Shaul, I discovered that there is a link between how much and what kind of alcohol you drink and the way that your bones turn out. And then he goes on to say there's also a link with the kind of food you eat. But what's very fascinating here is that clearly what Abba Shaul is doing is some level of research, of medical research, of data research on these bones and discovering that there is a connection with alcoholism. Now, Simon, Dr. Wiseman actually sent me a study and said, well, this actually is the case. There is a real connection between alcoholism and osteoporosis. And if you're interested, I brought you the link on the bottom, and I brought you a quote from the website of the doctors who've done a lot of research as to how people who are alcoholics, what effect that has on their bones. One of the less impressive conclusions they came to is that people who are alcoholics fall down more and therefore have more broken bones. Yeah, shkoyach. I think I could have worked that one out for myself without 15 years in medical school. But okay, there are other conclusions that they have as well. But here we have it, just to summarize. We've had a whole range of sources. We started with Yosef and Yaakov and embalming and mummification, but we've seen that the four major issues, let's summarize them before we finish. One is the mitzvah, the double mitzvah to bury. A second is the issue of kavod hameit and nivul hameit. A third is the issue of benefiting from the dead. A fourth is the issue of kapara, for the soul of the dead. And finally, we saw five cases where the Gemara talks about different types of autopsies, whether it was the death row victim, or whether it was the angry inheritor, whether it was the case of Abba Shaul at the end, and the other things we looked at there as well. All of this sets the scene for next week, when we're going to look into the modern day postscript. Maybe I'll leave you just in the last minute, and then Rabbi Shura, I see, is here. I'm sure he wants to reiterate the appeal for the fundraiser. But I'll just tell you the 30-second story. I was once asked many years ago to go to a funeral because one of my friends was concerned. It was a very rainy day. It was cold. They wouldn't get a minyan at her grandmother's funeral. So I went. I slept with a friend. We went to Bushi Cemetery, and we went to this funeral. In the end, there were lots and lots of people there. And we went, and we came out. We said, gosh, you know, we came all this way. We weren't really needed. They didn't need us. I lost a half a day coming here. Why did we do this? And then on the way out of Bushi, somebody called to us and said, please, can you come? We need desperately a minion. There's a mace mitzvah. It's a mace mitzvah. We ran over. We said, wow, look at this. We're here. We made the minion. This man died. He had no family. He had no friends. All that was left at his funeral was his lawyer. That's real, you know, a real problem, okay? And his lawyer said, his lawyer gathered us together, we went to the funeral, and he said, thank you so much, I'd like to read out a letter from my client to be read to the 10 men who made up the minion at his funeral. And I said to my friend, I said, this is it. The guy is obviously a billionaire, and he's left everything to the 10 men who came to his funeral. I said, this is the moment. Anyway, he read out this letter. The guy was not a billionaire. He just said, thank you very much. You did a big mitzvah, which Baruch Hashem we did, but that was not to be. But anyway, that's just a story, but it was a mitzvah. So I see Rabbi Shaw here, and I just want to finish by reiterating what we said at the beginning, that the OU is really reaching out to people to try and contribute to their fundraiser, and we will be terribly grateful for anyone who can do that. Rabbi Shaw, I don't know if you want to say anything, or if just being present and smiling.
I just want to say, first of all, thank you to Rabbi Manning for once again his inspiring teaching. That last story is actually a perfect segue. None of us are Hashem millionaires, but all of us can have a chelik in the mitzvah of sustaining the incredible Torah, the Harbat Sefer of OU Israel, and the incredible shiurim that has been offered.